You're listening to Portobello Talk Radio, the authentic voice of Ladbroke Grove.
Hello and welcome to the final show in Season 2 of Great Exchanges. Great Exchanges is a collaboration between Portobello Radio and Imperial College ahead of the Great Exhibition Road Festival in Exhibition Road on June the 15th and 16th. We bring together research scientists from Imperial and members of the community with lived experience to discuss issues that make a difference to people's everyday lives. In this episode, we're going to be looking at gut health. We hear a lot about gut health and the microbiome and probiotics, but what is actually going on inside you? And can we make a difference to our overall health by taking more care of our gut? I am delighted to be joined by, from Imperial, Ed Chambers. Hello, Ed.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we have Maisie Ringer with us. Maisie, who is one of our team here at Portobello Radio.
Yes, hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Ed, you are looking at the question of gut health. Now, it's a very topical subject at the moment. 30 different vegetables and fruits every week, 5 a day, eating your fibre. What is gut health and what is the gut that we're talking about?
That's a very, very good question. As you said, it's a term, this gut health, that we see very commonly in the media, but you know, we're really trying to work out what it actually means. I think from a sort of basic perspective, what we're looking at is these trillions and trillions of bacteria that are known to live within our gastrointestinal tract. So throughout our, we have this digestive system all the way from our mouth all the way through to our anus, so as from nose to tail, which has such an important role in digesting and absorbing the food that we eat. And one of these components are these bacteria that we have, particularly in our lower gut. And these bacteria have such a fundamental role on our overall health. And so what we eat sort of has a strong role in the sort of the composition and the sort of activity of these bacteria. And these have been linked to a number of sort of health outcomes and the development of disease and health maintenance as well.
What makes a difference to the health of your gut? Is it the food we eat? Is it the lifestyle we follow? Is it the amount of exercise we do? Or is it the additional products that are advertised widely at the moment?
Fundamentally, it is your gut microbiome, really, in terms of the health of it, is the sum, really, of your lifestyle factors. Predominantly what we eat, but also, as you mentioned, exercise has been sort of linked to altering how the gut functions, and also medications as well, what we consume. So importantly, and I'm sure we'll cover this at some point in this talk, particularly antibiotics. So unfortunately, for a number of diseases or health problems that we might have throughout life, we'll be given a course of antibiotics. And these have such a robust effect on sort of our bacterial species. By their very nature, they kill bacteria. So if you're taking an antibiotic, it's going to knock out or sort of diminish the amount of bacterial species that we have in the gut. But from a sort of everyday perspective, for the majority of the population, it's what we eat that has such a strong role on the type of bacteria that we have in the gut and how they actually influence our health. And really, from a dietary perspective, the work that I'm most involved with is looking at dietary fibre. And that's the component of the diet that really has the strongest effect on how our bacteria actually lives and flourishes.
What does fibre mean in this case? And what does that actually do when it passes through your system?
It's, again, excellent question. This is, you know, if you look on the back of your packet of any food products, it'll have the energy content, your carbohydrates, fats and proteins, and it'll also list this substance called fibre. And the vast majority of individuals, we've done public events, don't actually know what that actually is. What is fibre? Well, all it actually is the carbohydrate that we consume that we don't actually have enzymes in our body, so these chemicals, to actually break it down. So ourselves, as sort of humans, we are unable to actually process it. It just passes inertly through us. But say once you get down to this sort of lower end of the gut, we have these trillions and trillions of bacteria, and how they actually live is basically they ferment the fiber that we actually consume. So the more fiber you eat, essentially the more food you're providing to your bacteria to actually live and flourish. And it's this fermentation process that doesn't just produce, as we all know, anyone who's had a high fiber meal knows you produce lots of gas. But you also produce these metabolites, particularly called short chain fatty acids, that are being linked to more positive effect health benefits. So essentially the more short chain fatty acids that your gut microbiome can produce, this is sort of bringing it back to your first question associated with these positive effects on gut health.
Can I just ask a question? You're using all these words like bacteria, gas, anus, you know, and I mean, you've got to admit it's a relatively unsexy topic, but then it's being spoken about, you know, so much by like the likes of Gwyneth Paltrow and all the big celebrities. And as Piers was saying, it has become so topical. So why do you think that is? Why do you think gut health has become so topical like that?
I'm so glad you've used the term unsexy, because I think really that's unsexy. It's working in the field of fibre research is a very unsexy field. No one gets excited about fibre, but it has such a strong positive effect on health. And you know, population data shows if you're consuming more fibre, you are less likely to develop, you name a chronic disease, metabolic disease, mental health disease, you're less likely to, more fibre you consume, that's associated with a lower risk of developing these negative health outcomes. And it's, again, I go back to your, you know, farting is essentially good for you. That's, if you're farting, you are fermenting fibre. And your, you know, your gut is actually basically creating energy for itself and creating these byproducts that are actually good for ourselves. So in sort of scientific terms, it's this symbiotic relationship. So it's actually these bacteria are working with us for, you know, they're getting the actual energy from the fiber we eat. They're producing these short chain fatty acids from this fermentation process that have these positive effects on our overall health. You know, going back to Gwyneth Paltrow, I've no idea. It's particularly in the last sort of, again, 5 years, it has become a very hot topic in sort of a nutrition field, and whether it's just a new market, I'm not sure. There's money to be made, essentially.
There does seem to be a resistance amongst the population to eating their five a day. I mean, the guy, I can't remember when the government brought that in, it was kind of 20 years ago or so, and it's not a massive ask, five vegetables a day, but there does seem to be quite a resistance to it.
Yeah, and
can you explain that at all?
So just to go back into the UK government, this is not, you know, across most sort of government or organisations, would recommend you consume around 30 grams of fibre a day. So every day, 30 grams of fibre. And at a population level, less than sort of 10% of us actually regularly achieve this. So I think the average intake is around about 15 to 20 grams. So we are, at a population, very deficient in the amount of fibre we consume. And there's been some work sort of done to say, well, what are the main barriers? Why don't we eat more fibre? One of them is perceived cost. People believe that it's going to cost them a lot of money to actually every day eat the necessarily, you know, high fibre foods, things like fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, that you actually need to get 30 grams of fibre. And that's understandable. There's also an issue with, it's quite, some of the foods that you need to eat to get lots of fibre, they're quite time consuming. So one of the most, like, from a practical perspective, how can you actually eat more fibre? It's to substitute your white, like pasta and rice, for brown varieties. And that might sound very simple, but it takes, you know, particularly brown rice can take a lifetime.
It takes at least twice as long, doesn't it?
And if you've got two young children aged, you know, they are not going to wait that long for you to produce. So there are, you know, just lifestyle, you know, practical barriers that stop you from actually consuming high fibre foods. And one of the other barriers as well, it goes back to this whole issue of gastrointestinal. People think that if they eat 30 grams of fibre, they're going to be on the toilet all day or farting all the time. When in reality, that's what you actually want. That's actually a positive health, actually, you know, health outcome. I think we need to move away from farting or having regular bowel frequency being actually a negative outcome.
Yeah, well, the doctor always asks whether your bowels are regular, so I mean, there must be a reason for that.
Well, there is, and this is, you know, getting back to a serious point and say links between fiber and health. It's linked to constipation. So at a population level, we are a constipated nation. It's not something we actually talk about, but in terms of, like, from general practitioner surveys, one of the most common reason people attend GP practices is because they're constipated. And from a light, all that a GP can do, if they're not presenting with any other health issues, is lifestyle factors. Eat more fibre. And so this is costing the NHS millions and millions every week, because it's these not necessarily wasted GP appointments, but it's just through poor diet actually having this implication on people not going to the toilet regularly. And, you know, it might sound quite trivial that, you know, constipation, I'm just bunged up, but particularly this is very common in older adults, that, you know, constipation is linked to then reductions in overall diet quality. You're more anxious, you're less likely to actually leave the house because you're thinking that you could, you know, need to go to the toilet at any time. So it has major implications that, you know, affect large portions of society. So, yeah, just to bring it all back, fibre is a fundamental part of your diet.
In order to eat 30 grams of fibre, what does that translate to in terms of, you know, a pile of cabbage or a pile of carrots or...
Well, this is the great problem, that, you know, you can think that you're eating a huge plate of, say, cabbage, and that would be, you know, 100 grams of cabbage, but that's probably only going to be around 3 to 5 grams of actual fiber. The majority of that's just water in your cabbage. So you do actually need to, in terms of whole food, consume a very large amount of actual bulk material to get that 30 grams of fiber actually into your diet. So again, there's understandable, you know, barriers of why at a population level 90% of us don't eat the amount of fiber that we actually should.
Maisie, do you think you eat the right amount of fiber every day?
I'm embarrassed to say that I definitely don't think that I do. I grew up on a farm, so I'd say that when I was younger I was certainly getting loads of fiber. There was an apple tree next to our house, so I was scoffing apples all day, every day. But now, just finished a master's, I've been a student for the last 5 years, ridiculous amount of time. and during that time, obviously, I don't have heaps of money, so I'm more eating to get by as opposed to thinking about eating with my gut health at the forefront of my mind. And I'd say that the same would go for a lot of the student cohort, I guess.
Yeah, you're looking for as much energy density per pound as possible, not the nutritional quality, are you?
And it is something that I do think about. I do think about if I'm getting my 5 a day, for example.
And I think it's going back to, is that 5 a day is not going to get you 30 grams of fibre. And the 5 a day would really be the, not bare minimum, but that would get you at least to a, you know, adequate amount of fibre that you're not going to start developing bowel issues, essentially, in terms of you're not going to then get negative bowel health. It's just really, that's probably more from just to maintain gut health.
Do you think there is enough education out there about what constitutes the right amount of fibre or what needs to be consumed for a healthy gut then?
Not so, I think you've hit the, I think that's it. We don't, I think you look on, if we use, sorry, the most popular form of public information, probably the BBC website or something like that, and they sometimes have things on like gut health or dietary fibre, but it's very hidden away, it's not front and centre. And again, I think it does need better, I hate to use the term public education, but people probably at a fundamental level, it is going back to, well, what is fibre, why is it so important actually for you?
I mean, I have to say that it was a shock to me when you said that my plate of cabbage, I think 80 grams is what they say is a portion of vegetables. I assume that would be delivering me 30 grams of fibre, but I'm slightly shocked to hear that you get so little out of what seems like a huge plate of vegetables.
Yeah, exactly. And this is so some of the work that we do at Imperial is trying to work out, well, if we take sort of staple food products, things that they're actually commonly consumed in the UK diet, can we find alternative approaches to sort of raise the amount of fibre content within them? So some of the work that we've done is with pea produce, like growers, so the, you know, the humble garden pea, which is common, you know, a common...
The bird's eye pea.
The bird's eye pea, which is, you know, commonly consumed by a large proportion of the population. So can we identify other kinds of pea seeds that could be grown that are, you know, identical in appearance and acceptability to the consumer, but just naturally contain more fibre? So if, you know, per portion, you're actually just getting an extra 2-3 grams of fibre, if we can find other ways of doing that, so say the wheat that we use in our bread or things like that, then we might be able to, you know, people won't necessarily have to change what they eat, it'll just actually naturally contain more fibre.
Are there certain foods you can easily swap out? Because, I mean, like you were saying, white rice, brown rice earlier. Are there other foodstuffs which have a healthier counterpart which could easily be substituted in?
The easiest way is the browner it is, the more whole grain it's got, the higher the fibre content. So it is really moving away from white varieties to the, you know, brown. If you just go from your cereal example, if you go from your Rice Krispie to your bran flake, there you go. That's one, you know, one extreme
that's
to the other.
So,
but really, if it's not, if it's the browner it is, the more fibre.
So I mean, industrialisation is at the core of all this, isn't it? Because before the Industrial Revolution, most people in this country ate pea pottage.
Exactly.
All the time, which is what we would now know as split green peas or split yellow peas. As industrialisation has come in and we found ways to de-husk the brown rice and to get rid of some of the fibre out of wheat, we've actually degraded the quality of our food.
Exactly. And, you know, you've summed it up perfectly there in terms of if you look at the sort of hunter-gatherer diet in terms of what the sort of human gastrointestinal tract sort of evolved to actually be used to, that contained, you know, 100 grams of fibre a day, easily, every day. And it's really, say, only if you look at the sort of time course of, you know, human existence, it's only been relatively recently, in the last sort of 100 years or so, that we've just removed this fibre from our diet. And that's really, you know, our gut microbial composition would have drastically changed over the last 100 years, mirroring these dietary changes that have occurred. And it's just, obviously it's very associative, but as these dietary changes have occurred, as our gut microbiomes have changed, we have seen the increase in incidence of these sort of non-communicable diseases. So obesity rates have increased and, you know, associated obesity complications, so things like diabetes and cardiovascular disease. So again, that's very associative. We can't say that the gut microbiome has this strong causal relationship, but it's definitely, you know, there's more and more evidence showing that it has a contributing role.
So, I mean, picking up on Maisie's point, and so we can cheer everyone up a tiny bit, there are certain foods which really do provide some fibre that are very accessible. I mean, baked beans is one, is it not?
Baked beans is a fantastic example. So if you are to, you know, your beans on toast, you're going to get 10 grams of fibre. You could have a third of your daily intake a day just from beans on toast. So if you're looking at, you know, 50p can of baked beans, you know, for a pound, you're getting a third of your fibre intake in a nutritious meal. And then just bringing it back to the actual Great Exhibition, this is what I'm going to be involved with. It's working with a chef to actually, you know, devise meals or food items that sort of overcome these common barriers, so cost and time preparation. So they've produced a number of different, they're going to do demonstrations in terms of different foods that are, you know, samples will be available to actually try, which, you know, will provide you with a large amount of the amount of fibre that you need to consume.
What about, there are a lot of products on the shelf now that claim to improve your gut health, which is slightly ironic, of course, because we've already talked about the fact that if it says high fibre, people are scared away from it. But there are these products like kefir, like kombucha, sauerkraut now has got a very good name. The products on the shelves of the supermarket do they actually help your gut?
Yeah, yes, and I think bringing it back to this, you know, I think kefir and what else did you say?
Kombucha.
And kombucha. They're just, you know, they're products with very good PR at the moment. I think that's it. It's, you know, prebiotics, probiotics. They're just, you know, they've got, they're, that's really what's needed, I think. It's actually finding ways that are, you know, that it's actually acceptable at a population level, that things that people will actually consume to get more fibre into the diet. So bringing it back to your examples of your kombucha and kefir, they definitely, you know, there is evidence out there that regular consumption of these products does have beneficial effects on the gut microbiome. So you see increases in bacterial species that are associated with better fermentation and production of these short-chain fatty acids, which are beneficial to health. But you have to remember as well, an important factor is that if you're consuming these products, then you're taking something out of your diet. So how much of it is actually because you've actually eating something that's good for you, or you've actually removed something from your diet that's actually having negative effects? So when you look at these dietary studies, that's what you have to remember. Is it actually just because you're taking something out the diet rather than actually adding something in?
Maisie, do you go up and down the supermarket aisles looking for healthy products?
No, I don't. But a lot of my diet is made up of pasta and rice. But I could definitely swap that out for brown rice and pasta, even if I don't want to.
And what about vegetables?
I'm good with my vegetables. Fruit and vegetables I've got covered. I just stir fry everything, really.
Well, that's very good. Again, because what you have to remember is it's not just, if we take, I'm trying to think of an example. What's something that you might process, like cut up lots or mash or something like that? Even let's just take a potato.
Mm.
Like the amount of fibre you would get from that, like if you just take your raw potato, the amount of fibre you'd get in from it would depend on how you cook or process it. So if you mash up your potato, you're going to break down a lot of the actual cell walls in it. So you're going to actually, the fibre wouldn't actually behave like a fibre. It would actually then be actually available for digestion. Whereas if you actually eat or just boil the potato. So this is where, as well, from a UK perspective, we're very sort of poor at what sort of how we actually eat our food. If we think, I feel my own parents, they will boil the absolute life out of, you know, vegetables, whether there's actually any fiber or anything left in these vegetables when they actually consume it.
Is there something in our physiology that makes it difficult when we're young to accept fiber? Is there something happening as the fiber goes through our system that we resist?
Not that we've ever really come across. It's just that we're naturally hardwired to want high sugar, high fat foods, really. We are, you know, from an evolutionary perspective, that's what we need. And I can't think of an example of a food item that's high in sugar, high in fat, but also is also high in fiber. So I think it's more from that essence, that because high fiber foods don't contain a lot of sugar and fat, that we don't necessarily find them as appealing. From a lot of things, you could tell how much fiber is in it from the how tough the skin is on the outside. That's really a good example. The tougher the skin, the more high fiber that's in it. So again, this again goes back to food preparation. A lot of the actual fiber is on the actual outside of the veg. Never, you know, wash it, but never remove the actual outer layer of a fruit or vegetable.
The Great Exhibition Road Festival is on this year, the 15th and 16th of June, and you will be in the Future Food Live section zone. Can you tell us a little bit about how that zone's going to work over the 2 days?
There's not just going to be myself talking about high like fiber foods and ways to get fiber into your diet. There's going to be other exhibitions and interactive displays and, you know, food being produced, which touches on, you know, important issues for the future. So one being developing food from what we'd consider to be food waste, so much more from a sustainable aspect, and also the development of alternative proteins as well. That's incredibly important with, you know, changes in with climate change and other aspects. It's really how, you know, farming practices, whether these are going to be actually be maintainable in the future, and we might actually need to come up with alternative ways to get protein in our diet. So things like insects and things like this might actually need to eat them to get the amount of protein in our diet, or other lab-grown protein sources.
The food that keeps coming to my mind throughout all this conversation is pulses and legumes. You've already mentioned baked beans, but they are quite high in protein.
Yep.
And they also provide you with a lot of fibre. Is that the future? Everyone eating lentils and black beans?
I think that's the future from a sort of public message perspective. Again, it's all about adoption, though. It's all very well having these recommendations, but how are you going to get the majority of the population to actually consume an increased amount of legumes in their diet? And this is where we're going to need some, you know, clever marketing to actually increase the attractiveness of eating more lentils, I think. And pulses, beans, but these are foods that are, you know, tremendously good for you.
Is there part of your work that is trying to find solutions that encourage people to improve their diet and thus their gut health?
Some, not as much. My work's mainly looking at some of the physiological aspect of it. So working out, you know, if you take groups of individuals and increase their fibre intake, why is that associated with positive effects? So looking at the gut microbiome, looking at these signals that are actually produced, and looking at how they actually improve our health outcomes. So predominantly what this has looked at is the positive effects that fiber has on your appetite regulation. So again, through this process of fermentation of the fiber and this creation of these metabolites called short chain fatty acids, these actually stimulate the release of these hormones from your gut that actually make you feel full. So again, it's bringing it back to the more fiber you're consuming, the more fermentation that's occurring, you can actually stimulate these gut hormones that actually stop you from feeling hungry. And that's one of the reasons why, like, high fiber diets have these positive effects on body weight, is because they actually make you feel really full through this fermentation response.
That seems to be an area that could be pursued. I mean, weight loss is... It's the holy grail and has been for some time. Ozempic is one solution, and the drugs that suppress your appetite. But a much healthier way forward would be to encourage people that they're not... Could you say you're going to lose weight or you're going to stabilise your weight?
I think you've really, again, touched on it there. It's very much looking at... We've more looked at it from a preventative angle. And in term, and rather than a treatment angle, I think if you've got pre-existing obesity, I think, hand on heart, if I'm being honest, just getting more fibre in your diet is not going to cause you to radically lose a lot of body weight. However, if you're like Maisie here, a young adult, that, you know, between the age of 18 to 40, what is the average weight gain? Average. Putting you on the spot here.
Yeah, you really are. I genuinely don't know.
It's about 10 kilos, so a stone and a half. So that's where, in adulthood, that's where you'll gain your most weight, is that.
Up to age 40.
Yeah, 80. And then sort of weight is relatively stable. So it's whether in that early phase of adulthood, if we can get, you know, that crucial time in life, you've left university, you're independent, you're cooking on your own. If you could actually consume more fibre, will that actually prevent that weight gain from occurring? And then you'll be more, you know, your risk of developing these metabolic complications in later life will be a lot lower. So that's one of the areas that we're actually looking at. I think it's targeting at the right, you know, the right sectors of society where it could have the greatest effect.
So to sum up, Ed, it does appear that gut health is very central to your general health and plays a major part in staving off some of the diseases which have beset us as a post-industrial society. Would that be fair to say?
I think that's an excellent summary of really the situation in terms of, fibre has such a fundamental role on human health through its effects and the gut, and particularly the gut microbiome. And I think it's an area of opportunity for the food industry to really find ways to actually get more fibre within a typical population diet.
Getting more fibre, which improves your gut health, can impact diseases from depression to cardiovascular heart attacks, from bowel cancer to irritable bowel syndrome.
Exactly. And I think, you know, it was always, you know, the strongest evidence was always for fibre having this sort of protective effect on developing bowel issues. So things through, you know, from irritable bowel disease through to sort of colorectal cancers, through these sort of local effects that it's having within the gut. But the gut microbiome has such a strong effect on our what's termed our gut barrier. So essentially what that does, as its name suggests, is it keeps things within the gut. It stops things getting into the circulation. So sort of a poor diet, particularly a fibre-depleted diet, that's sort of associated with a very poor gut barrier. So what you actually get are things that should be passed out in our poo actually get into the circulation. And what this can do is like trigger inflammatory responses and sort of aggravate a lot of poor metabolic states. So things like diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and also is implicated in, you know, issues such as depression and anxiety-like behaviours.
Earlier on, you mentioned antibiotics. Now, obviously, a lot of us need antibiotics every now and then for some disease or other. What does an antibiotic do to our probiotic gut makeup?
Well, antibiotics, by their sort of say very nature, they are indiscriminatory in terms of the bacteria that they would kill in the gut. So essentially, following a bout of antibiotics, you are going to get a reduction in your bacterial communities in your gut. And this is where I think dietary intervention is emerging, has such a strong role. It's actually this post antibiotic intervention period in terms of what should we be eating to actually get your gut microbiome, get those numbers back to sort of high levels so that you have a sort of full protection within your gut. Because as you could imagine, if you're having an period of antibiotic treatment and you then have a very low fibre diet or sort of a high fat, high sugar diet, you could be, you know, take a very long time to actually get those bacterial numbers back and be, you know, exposing yourself to potential gut problems.
So one practical thing that people could take from this is, even if you can't manage your 30 grams a day on a regular basis, you should really concentrate and prioritise that if you've been on a course of antibiotics.
Exactly. I think there are periods in life like that where, you know, a high fibre diet would be, you know, of particular importance.
So Maisie, you've heard that you need to improve your gut diet right now, because the next 20 years are the crucial moment. What do you take away from what you've heard today?
It's fascinating. I'm ashamed to say, never really paid it much attention in the past, but it's really, really interesting, especially that my age group is like not the target audience, but if we start looking at our gut health now, it could have the largest, you know, the most positive future impact.
Exactly. I think how we've looked at it, just to butt in, how we've looked at it previously, and perhaps incorrectly, is we've waited for issues to develop. We've waited for people to gain lots of weight and develop these metabolic conditions. Well, how about we actually just stop it from occurring?
And if there are any mothers out there with young children, you know, we've mentioned the fact that all they seem to want to eat is fish fingers or white pasta. Is there a way that mothers can introduce more fibre into a child's diet so that it becomes part of their everyday?
With great difficulty. I think this is one of those areas where, you know, it's an idealist, you know, you'd want to be getting as much fruit, vegetables, as mixed as well into your child as possible. But yeah, it's all very well for me to say do that, but having got two young children, I know the great difficulties of it. That's very much one of those, yeah, people suffer enough with children without being told what they need to feed them.
Thank you, Ed, so much. We look forward to seeing you at the Future Food Live Zone at the Great Exhibition Road Festival on the 15th and 16th of June. I understand the chef is going to be cooking bibimbap, Korean bibimbap.
That is correct, but a very high fibre variety.
Great. Thank you. And thank you, Maisie. We look forward to seeing the improvements in your lifestyle. Thanks for listening to Great Exchanges. It's a collaboration between Portobello Radio and Imperial College and is part of the Great Exhibition Road Festival celebrations. Wherever you found this podcast, there'll be information on the front page telling you more about how you can get involved in the issues we've been talking about. Thanks for listening. This is Portobello Radio. My name is Piers Thompson.